Good evening. I have a short announcement. That is that I talked to Beth Ann this morning. She's not in Cambodia at the moment. She's in Menlo Park. But she is going to come and visit with us as usual on the 6th of October, I think. That first Tuesday of October. She wants to talk about equanimity because she has so little of it, she says, and thinks it's so important. So she's made a big study of it and wants to share what she's discovered. I'm not sure everybody was here last week. Do you know everyone here? This is Alan. Why don't you?
I'm Donald and
Alan.
Richie.
Wendy.
Dan.
Jane.
Bruce.
Lauren.
Julie. You won't remember them all, but that's okay. So, you all are wondering if I remember or not. I think it's 14. Yeah? Thank you, Julia.
In an evening talk, he said, even worldly people, rather than study many things at once without really becoming accomplished in any of them, to just do one thing well and steady enough to be able to do it even in the presence of others.
How much the more is this true of the supramundane Buddha Dharma? Supramundane. It is a way which such beginningless path has not been cultivated or practiced, and therefore it is now still far from us. Our natures too are dull. In this exalted and far-reaching Buddha Dharma, if one takes on too many things at once, it will be impossible to perfect even one thing. Even concentrating solely on one thing, those whose faculties and capacities are dull by nature will have difficulty in thoroughly mastering it. Strive, students, to concentrating on one thing alone.
Iho asked, if so, then what thing, what practice in the Buddha Dharma should we be solely devoted to cultivating? Dogen replied, although it should be in accord with potentiality and conform to capability, that which is now transmitted and solely practiced in the school of the patriarchs is sitting meditation. This practice takes in all potentials and is a method which can be practiced by those of superior, middling, and inferior faculties of life.
When I was in the community of my late master Tiantong Monastery in China, after hearing this truth while sitting still day and night, the monks thought in times of extreme heat or extreme cold that they would probably become sick, so they temporarily left off sitting. At that time I thought to myself, even if I should become sick and die, still I should practice this. If I fail to practice when I'm not sick, what is the use of treating this body tenderly? If I sicken and die, this is my will. To practice and die in the community of a master in the great country of China, and having died, to be disposed of by a worthy monk, this would above all form an excellent affinity for a good birth. If I died in Japan, I couldn't be disposed of by such a man in accordance with the Buddhist ceremony, which is in conformity with Dharma. If I kept practicing and died before realizing enlightenment, or having established having established this affinity, I should have been born in a Buddhist family. If I do not practice, even if I maintain bodily life for a long time, it would be worthless. What would be the use? While my body is sound and I feel I will not fall ill, when unexpectedly I may drown in the ocean or meet an unforeseen death, how will I regret it afterwards?
I continue to deliberate in this manner and being firmly resolved, as I sat upright day and night, I did not get sick at all. Now, if each of you should be thoroughly determined to practice and see, 10 out of every 10 of you should attain the way. The exhortations of my late master at Tian Tun were like this.
So again, of course, you remember that he is talking to monks in a monastery. So there's really nothing else to do in the monastery except the jobs of keeping it clean and cooking the food. But you can imagine how many times people would find all kinds of reasons not to sit, that it's too cold or it's too hot or something is wrong. I think everybody does that. Even though we really want to sit, often there's resistance. And part of the resistance, I think, is just trying to stay alive and valuing the life of our body so much that we try to surround ourselves with safety. And it's partly to do with that, our self-importance, of course. We're too important to die. I remember when I took a trip with my Tibetan friend, Tinley, and she took us high back into the Himalayas, back to Ladakh, back to Leh. And the roads there are not as wide as this room, and wind through the mountains on the edge of cliffs, thousands of feet above sheer cliffs with a river far, far below. You can hardly see it, it's so far down. And in a little jeep, bumping along on this little dirt road, and coming the other way were army trucks going very fast. And they would scrape by the side, and we would teeter right on the edge of the cliff, hour after hour after hour. And at first it was terrifying. It was simply, I thought, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And then started thinking, well, here I am in the Himalayas, going from practice place to practice place to these incredible monasteries, with all the blessings of the monks and nuns that we had met, and traveling with Tinley, who is a very extraordinary and wonderful practicer. It seemed finally that it was a good place to die. If we had to die, why not? You know, and of course we do have to die. So once you get over that piece of it, oh, I have to die anyway, then why not now? If I have to die now, that's okay. That's really fine. It's a good time and a good place because all these factors have come together. Don't always feel that way, but I think it's the truth of it any time and any place. If we really scrutinize where we are and see it clearly, we don't have to worry so much about whether we're hot or we're cold. Just to do and be what we're already determined to do and be, just complete that moment after moment. I like what he says about doing one thing well and study enough to be able to do it even in the presence of others. That's kind of a test, isn't it? Because we expose ourselves in anything that we do. And to do, really give ourselves to something and then allow ourselves to be seen, that's a very big deal. And yet that's what we do in practice. Sometimes people practice for years by themselves in their bedrooms before they come to a sitting group. And it's a big change. You become more vulnerable. It took a lot to get Dogen to China from Japan. It was a very dangerous trip already. And he went through a terrific storm, prayed to Avalokiteshvara, and attributed their safety and their successful journey to compassion itself. It's wonderful. But he knows what danger is and how to be so determined, so one-minded about it. These things about different kinds of rebirth, I always think we don't have to take literally unless we want to. Some people do. But I think psychologically it makes a lot of sense. Just in the moment that if we, how does he lay it out? Dying before realizing enlightenment, to be reborn in a Buddhist family. If you consider your life and your own determination, your own way-seeking mind, how can I say, you're already there. If you haven't got there yet and you feel like you haven't gotten there yet, then there's a discordance. There's the where I am and the where I want to be. It's a part of way-seeking mind. It's the place just before that kicks in. I'm somewhere and I know there's somewhere else to be. Psychically, intentionally, what my intention is. And then once it begins, then there's a feeling of being on the way. Even though we don't really know what the way is, something is carrying us as we go. Are there questions? Dan?
I love the way you present. You know, I think there are questions buried in Dogen, but you make it easy to find things for us in the text, and I think that's really what spoke to me tonight when we were talking was one of the first things you said is this problem of it seems that most of the time your life is categorized into two things. You're either trying to avoid something that you don't want or preferring something you do. And somehow the practice seems to be at the transition point of those two. You're letting go of those things that you don't want to be averse to, and you're detaching from wanting what you want. Mm-hmm. And there's very, like, if you have to measure it in the proportion of time, like one half of 1% of the time, you're not wanting and not pushing away. And it seems like the rest of the time you're in the two other categories. And it's just so easy, you know, the practice kind of, at least my practice, shows me that all the time. Like, it's that preference and aversion I see all the time. And yet, it doesn't also feel right, because I know that I'm pushing or pulling. And how many times you can just taste the food without saying, boy, I want more of this, and yeah, yesterday's lunch was horrible. I mean, just to be tasting the food.
You have to kiss yourself goodbye, as if you're on a bumpy road thousands of feet above a river, and just be willing to give yourself away. Give up. And then whatever happens, it's gravy. It doesn't have the same intensity of either aversion or desire. They still pass through, but you don't feel it's not a life and death thing anymore, because you've already given yourself up. So it doesn't matter.
It's a very interesting thing. I've often thought about this, that a succinct verbal description of the practice is being able not to care. That sounds rough. It sounds very uncompassionate. Mm-hmm. In some senses, you have to let yourself not care. You have to let yourself not be tied to either pushing or pulling. No. And that seems hard for me, given all that we've also learned about, you know, compassion that comes out of practice. That doesn't seem like the right way to describe it.
Well, because the not caring is doesn't apply to everything else. It just applies to you.
But there's no,
you're the one that gets stirred up.
But there's no other way to the big mind except through my little mind. I've got no choice.
As long as you're thinking about it, yes. Julian?
Our thoughts are our brain, right? I mean, like, it's our organ, the brain is an organ and it has all these thoughts going on. I mean, I was thinking in terms of, like, the whole I don't care thing. It's almost, I mean, it's an idea just like anything else, and with any idea comes, like, the antithesis of that idea. So that's why, I don't know, like, I've felt this dynamic of if, you know, if you, like, whatever, advertise to the world you don't care, it's most likely that somebody is going to really poke and prod you on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it sets up this, like, dynamic,
mm-hmm,
that ends up kind of suffering, getting kicked in the, you know, where,
yes,
you know. It's still just like an idea.
Yes. Yes.
I think it's very, I don't know, it's important not to devalue, though, thought, as if, like, you have to, like, bust our brain. That's not, I don't think that's what we're
No, going. No, that isn't the point at all. But the idea that is getting in our way is our idea of ourself. And that's what we're protecting. That's what we're, that's the veil through which we try to see what's there, and we hardly can see through it. So that we don't even really know who we are or what the world is because we're so tangled up in our own ideas about ourselves. So as long as we're thinking, we're building up and rebuilding and rebuilding and tearing down and putting up better ways of keeping ourselves safe and well-defined. That's all a thought process. And as long as we're doing that, we can't very well see what's here. And what's here is actually ourself. The whole thing, yeah. So our thinking is very valuable. We need it extremely much, and we've come through with incredible things because we are able to think. But if we only think and depend only on our thinking, we miss the truth of things. We miss our real truth because we're caught by the thought of ourself.
It's just, I mean, I'm here, you're there, and
yes.
I mean, cognition is fallible, no doubt, but I don't know, like, people need to also take care of them.
Of course.
Themselves, and there's not, they can't control what's...
We can't control very much of anything, which is why we do prostrations. As soon as we're down on the ground, we disappear, and we lift up what we can't even know. Everything that makes everything work and go. We think we are controlling it, but we're not. We control this little teeny bit of it, maybe sometimes, if we're lucky. A lot of times what we think we're controlling, we're not. Now, even the car that we drive is driving us, too. So in a way, it's giving up our pride because we like to feel like we're in control. We're the ones who are doing it, and we've got it. We can figure it out. If we can't figure it out, we get uncomfortable. Because not figuring it out is, it feels like we don't know what's going to happen next. But of course we don't know what's going to happen next.
I'm just thinking about, like, people, like, been in an abusive situation. I mean, this is a, you know.
Sure, they have to get out of it.
Where does this, like, right. I mean, and I could understand how thought kind of could prevent someone from getting out of the situation because their
thought has made a world in which they have to accept it.
Right.
Right. So breaking through those thought patterns is what this practice is about. It's not getting rid of them, it's seeing through them or breaking them up so that you can see what the reality of things is. That's a great example. Many people who are abused accept it year after year after year and feel they have no choice. And once they see they do, it doesn't mean that they kill the abuser or even kick him around. They can see through their situation and understand it. And then they know what to do. And that's liberation. It's very simple, really. When we talk about liberation, it sounds like, you know, glowing lights and all this. It's just so obvious and so simple. And yet it's so hard to do. So hard for us to see ourselves well enough to be able to do it. So sitting down like this, where all we've got left is just what's happening right here, then we can begin to see what's happening right here. see it's all a dream. Jane?
This might be non sequitur, but when I come back after being away for 2 weeks, I can feel my heart responding to our Sangha and to this form. And I can feel the longing for maybe that's what it is. Just the refuge.
Yeah.
And I'm just really very happy to be with the Sangha tonight.
Well, we're very happy to have you here. It's very sweet all the way around, I think. Because who knows how we gather and what this is. But what a great good fortune it is that we've found ourselves this way. Thank you. Yeah. And how wide it is, really, when I start to think about various people and what's happening here and there, my mind just goes out, out, out. There's so many of us. You know, someone who sat with us last year in Carmel, or somebody who came to visit, or we went to see. There's so many. Well, I bet it's... No, there are 5 more minutes. How about that? Donalyn?
I was reflecting when you went like this. I was thinking of Manjushri.
Ah, yes.
It hits home. So Manjushri is in the meditation hall. Again, for that liberation, cutting through all of it. I really like this symbols. So you're on a white elephant, you should like you're on your brown cushion cut through. Show us.
Well, Manjushri is on a lion.
Is that what it's
yes, like? Yes. Samantapandra is on an elephant. Manjushri is the bodhisattva, or the image, the metaphor, and they usually have a sculpture of it instead of Buddha in the sitting hall. Buddha's in the Dharma hall where the talks are given, but Manjushri is in the sitting hall because everyone who is sitting is Buddha itself. So it's redundant to have a Buddha figure. So the Manjushri figure is usually somebody with a sword in one hand and a flower, a lotus flower with a book on it, resting on it in the other hand. The Lotus Sutra, the sort of magical sutra that... that's not Manjushri though, is it? Oh, yes, it is. That's right. It is Manjushri.
There is the flower. I guess that square thing is a book.
Is a book, yes. Yeah. Yes, that's the Lotus Sutra. That's right. That's right. Yes. Yes. Maha Praj... No. Mm. Yes, you do. Isn't that funny? Saddharma Pundarika Sutra is the Lotus Sutra. The great Manjushri Bodhisattva is the one of wisdom, the wisdom of sitting, that our own natural wisdom comes up as we sit. And the sword just breaks up all those fake ideas that we carry and lets the light shine through. Samantabhadra is also a bodhisattva of wisdom, the one on the elephant, but the wisdom that goes out into the world. So Samantabhadra is out riding on an elephant, this very slowly walking through the world. I like that image. It's so unspeedy. It's just real quiet and slow.
Gradual
awakening. Yeah. Oh, thank you. I'd forgotten we'd changed the image. But we did. We had a Manjushri before, didn't we?
He's embedded in the altar.
Uh-huh.
But he's Manjushri also.
Yeah. Well, those are wonderful metaphors. Well, thank you all.